bangthebook.com.
Hello once again, everybody. Thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, March 1st edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour. We go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me as we kick off a new month. The month of madness is here, so plenty of things to get to on today's show. We're going to start things off with Wes Reynolds for our Wednesday wagering segment. We'll chat with Wes here about the WGC Mexico Championship, a new event on the PGA Tour. And we'll also get some thoughts from him on conference tournament betting, some of the things that he's looking for. Hopefully we can talk about some of those futures, creating hedging opportunities, all that type of stuff there with him. Second half of today's show, Chris Stone of FanSided joins us. We'll chat college basketball with him, take a look at how the bubble is shaping up here for the final couple of regular season games, and then maybe take a look ahead to the conference tournaments as well, discuss some teams that may need to add a little bit more to their resumes, and then also some that could make a surprise Sweet 16 or Elite 8 run. Again, we want to start looking toward that futures market, look for opportunities to make some profit in March Madness. So we'll do that with Chris Stone. I'll also try to fill in the gaps a little bit with some MLB, also some NHL. The first round of my season win totals went up last night. The American League East, the American League Central will go up tomorrow. Try to do it every other day here so I can try and catch up a little bit with the National League, but I'll keep you posted as those are going up. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and chat with today's first guest. That is Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds, the number one on Twitter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Hey, Adam. How are you today?
Doing very well, man. Appreciate your time as always. Thank you so much for joining us here. I guess let's start with the golf stuff because I think that this is really compelling. We've got a new event here, the WGC Mexico Championship. Of course, this used to be the WGC Cadillac down at Trump's Doral course. With some of the comments that Trump made during his presidential campaign, PGA Tour officials opting to move this tournament. So this is a course that we haven't seen, and also this is a course that has a very high elevation, one that we don't see in any of the North American events.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wish the event was still at Doral because you had more form, and I like the Doral course. But, you know, this is an interesting add, I think, to the tour, the fact that it, you know, it is kind of a classical old-style feel. It's tree-lined fairways. The greens aren't necessarily very big. So it's a little bit like you would find like a tight track in Spain, kind of a little bit like maybe a Valderrama. And then, I mean, it's 7,000 feet of elevation. So, I mean, it's a 7,300-yard course, but, you know, it'll play much shorter than that because of the elevation. It's an old classical course, 7,300 yards, Kukuya fairways, bent poa greens. So the Kukuya fairways, that's the similar surface that we saw at Riviera a couple weeks ago. But this is a very interesting course, and you know, it was something where you really had to maybe dig a little deeper to find if there is any potential correlation, which I was able to find on a couple guys, because if you look at the courses that are kind of played at elevation, the only one really played on the PGA Tour is the Barracuda Championship, the former Reno Tahoe Open, which usually doesn't get the best feel because it's usually the alternate event from the WGC at Firestone. But you also had the 2014 BMW Championship, one of the FedEx Cup playoff events that was played at Cherry Hills in Denver, since they don't have an event there in Denver anymore. It used to be called the International, which was in Castle Pines, which was a Stableford scoring format, but they did away with that many years ago. And on the European Tour, looking at the past results of the Omega European Masters, which is usually played in Switzerland, so those were kind of the correlations that I found in terms of maybe being able to apply them to these events. I mean, nothing is for certain because they haven't really played this course before. So, but that's what I was kind of looking at least this week.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at as well. And that one in Switzerland was the one that jumped off the page to me right away. And if anybody's never heard of that course, I believe it's called Cran Sur Sierre, and I apologize if I'm butchering that pronunciation because I'm sure I am. But if you get a chance to look at that course, it is an incredible backdrop. It is absolutely beautiful. It's also about 10,000 feet above sea level, so it's a little bit higher than this course is. But you know, this is a really interesting field because with it being a WGC event, you have a lot of European Tour players over here. I'm sure you looked at that relative to that Omega European Masters event. Also, we're getting into that point where, you know, guys want to come over and play stateside. The Masters coming up here in about a month. So should have a lot of really strong fields here going forward. About the fact that this is a strong field, you've got some really, really good players that are going off at exceptional odds this week.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, the only really high-profile player missing this week is Jason Day, who withdrew with an illness. I mean, you're going to get a fair amount of withdrawals with Jason Day. He's always, you know, hurt or he's got an illness. So, you know, kind of yet another malady, I guess, for Day here. But, yeah, all the guys that are in this tournament, all the biggies who have won so far this year, pretty much Matsuyama, Johnson, Spieth, Ricky Fowler from last week, and, of course, McIlroy making his return after a brief respite with that wrist injury, Henrik Stenson. So you've really got all the pretty much all the biggies in this field, John Rahm as well, who's already won on tour. So, you know, a lot of guys to choose from as well in this field this week.
Well, I noticed the lowest price you have here on your board, a guy that's a very, very good player, also a guy that's played well in that event over in Switzerland, Sergio Garcia. Is that what you like about him this week, how he's performed on some of these high-altitude courses, or you just feel like this is a good fit for him?
You know, it's really a little bit of both. Obviously has an excellent record at the Omega Masters, which we talked about. He has a first place, and then three other top six finishes in the five times he's played there. He, you know, has done very well at altitude. He won earlier. He's already won this year, won the European Tour event over in Dubai. His two events that he has had over here, he only finished 49th at Riviera and then was 14th last week at the Honda, but was very high on his ball striking. I think he finished second for the week in the ball striking stats. But I think, you know, a lot of people kind of backed him because he was one of the shorter prices last week at the Honda, and he disappointed. And sometimes when a guy disappointed, people kind of want to go away from him. But then usually the next week or the next time out, he's usually up there in contention. So, you know, I think he's ready for a big performance. He always performed well at this event at Doral. And he's comfortable with this event. Also, I briefly mentioned Valderrama, which is a tree line course, of course, in Spain. And, I mean, this is a guy that has finished outside the top 10 at Valderrama, and you'd expect him to play well being a Spaniard, but he's only, I believe, finished outside the top 10 at that Valderrama event one time in 12 tries. So, you know, he's got good form, and I think, you know, it's going to come down to the putter, because I think he's going to hit the ball well, and he's going to hit the ball long at this altitude, and he's going to hit it pretty straight. He's just got to make some putts and get some of them to go down. And I think this very much could be the week. And I've kind of said on this podcast previously, I think this might be the year where he's going to get the major that has eluded him for his whole career, and mentioned the fact that he recently got engaged and, you know, is going to be married. And I think that's good for him personally. And he's won three times in just a little over a year lately. So you got a guy that's playing pretty good golf, and I think he's a little bit under the radar of those top guys this week.
Well, as you mentioned a little bit there in your intro, with the elevation for this tournament, you know, we're going to have some guys really hitting some bombs off the tee. Some of these par fours that are 380-ish are going to be drivable for these guys. So it should be a very interesting event for sure. And one guy that can definitely shorten this course a little bit, a guy that you took at 40-1 is Gary Woodland.
Yeah, and I wish I would have got him early at 50-1. I hope that this isn't a bad sign that a lot of people are on him, but I think he really fits here. He, of course, is a guy that has won the Barracuda Championship, the Reno Tahoe Open before, so back in 2013, and that features Bent and Poa Nuagreen, just like this one does. But he's a guy that's also really playing well. He's got a couple second place finishes, including last week, and then a fifth in his previous start. So the current form is right there. And the all-around, he was third in Mayakoba. He was second at the Sony. He was third at Pebble, and he was actually first last week in the all-around, first in total driving in his last two events. So the guy is really playing excellent. And it looked like he was kind of going to put a little bit of pressure on Ricky, but Ricky Fowler, after a shaky start on Sunday, kind of pulled it together as he was going into the back nine and making the turn, and was able to kind of hang on and have enough distance between him and the rest of the field. But Woodland is a guy that looks like he's ready for a win, and I don't like the do factor. I don't necessarily like that term, but if anybody is, I think it's Woodland.
You got a couple of shots here in the 50 to 55 to 1 range. One of them, Martin Kaymer, a guy that, of course, has extensive playing time on the European Tour, so he's played in some of these altitude courses before. Also, Paul Casey, a guy who finished up pretty strong last year throughout the FedEx Cup playoffs events. Mixed results here so far this year, but what do you like about these two guys?
Yeah, with Kaymer, I thought he actually played very, very solid last week. His strength of his game is, I think, the distance control with his irons. And he finished tied for fourth last week at PGA National. He's hit a lot of his greens in his European Tour events. I believe he was, at 76% in greens and regulation in these few European Tour events he's played. So he's a guy that's also played in these courses with elevation and usually goes pretty well. Casey's just a guy that I think is a little bit overlooked. He's been, hot. He hasn't played poorly by any stretch, but I think you're getting a good price. And Paul Casey has kind of been, we've seen his game reemerge. I mean, not to the level where he was, top three in the world several years ago, but, he's been kind of knocking on the door. And I think just needs that big win. And I think a lot of the I don't know if it's stress or what it is, was that the fact that he's not playing really on the European Tour. He's playing exclusively over here. So, a lot of that stuff around him and a lot of the questions were about, hey, not playing for the European Ryder Cup team, because, of course, you have to play a minimum amount of events over there to be able to qualify, since the European Tour is the one that oversees the Team Europe Ryder Cup team. But, I think that's kind of behind him. And he's a guy, also a really good ball striker, that I think fits pretty well here. And, getting him a little bit over 50, I think, isn't necessarily a bad price here.
No disrespect to Ben Ahn, but I want to make sure I mention the two triple-digit shots that you're looking at. The first one is Danny Willett. And I mean, this was a play that I kind of isolated right from the jump. He's a guy that's played very well in that event in Switzerland. Of course, won the Masters last year and hasn't really had as much success stateside as you would expect for a guy that's the reigning Masters champion. But man, you got to like the fact that he has a lot of experience in conditions like this.
Yeah. And I think, looking at Danny, earlier this year, He should have won the Maybach Championship in Malaysia, because I think he kind of struggled, being used to be the Masters champion, and then, of course, the Ryder Cup, where he didn't play very well at all, and I think his brother kind of popping his mouth off really didn't help him. And, I think his confidence did get shaken a little bit off of that, and he kind of struggled, but, he came should have won the Maybach, wasn't able to close the deal on Sunday, but he's been very, very good in some of these big tournaments. And made the cut last week, didn't necessarily play great, but he has made the semifinals at the World Match Play, finished third at the HSBC Champions event over in China that they have, but actually last week he missed the cut, but he did shoot an opening 69 last week, and then had a double with two holes to play on Friday that had him miss the cut by a shot. But I think that this is a course where he's going to like it. If you look at some of the tree line courses that he's played very well, Augusta National obviously being the most obvious, but over in Kuala Lumpur at Malaysia, where he should have won this year, Kranz, the Omega Masters, Wentworth, where they have the BMW PGA Championship, and they've had the match play there in the past. He's won at altitude. He's a guy that's beaten the best players. So I just think that this is a little bit of an overlay. This is almost more of a price play because, I mean, a guy like Danny Willett, who's the defending Masters champion, shouldn't be triple digits in this event. And I think that price is a little bit ridiculous. And I think he just needs a good tournament over here to get his confidence. And I think this could potentially be the spot.
The other guy on your card this week, Charles Schwartzel, about 145. This is a guy that can really bomb it as well. So I assume that sort of factors into your thought process there. Make sure you head on over to Wes's timeline at Wes Reynolds, the number one. Check him out. He'll have some matchups and stuff like that as we get closer to the start of this event tomorrow. But Wes, I wanted to take some time to talk college basketball with you here because it's conference tournament time. And I know you're a high volume guy. You're always looking for those edges when you have them. I want to get your thoughts on playing these conference tournament futures. Is that something that you like to do? And if so, are you looking to peg the winner or are you just looking to guarantee some profit?
It's a little bit of both. And I've only played one of these conference tournament futures so far, and I played Lipscomb in the ASUN. It's slightly under 3-1. I think Lipscomb and Gulf Coast are clearly the two best teams in that conference, even though I think Kennesaw State with Al Skinner, who's a pretty crafty coach, could maybe give Gulf Coast a challenge in the semifinals. But some of these ones that have started already, I've kind of liked the chalky teams a little bit, like Bucknell and the Patriots or Winthrop in the Big South. I've kind of, liked the favorites here because, I'm going by their conference schedule and who they played. I mean, we know that there's going to be some upsets in these things. So, you don't be afraid to take a little bit of a long shot, especially in some of these major tournaments. I mean, if you look at something like the Big 12, I mean, clearly, they always say the old adage that the Big 12 championship goes through Lawrence, and of course they're going to win it again, it looks like, in the regular season. But you look at that conference, there's not really a bad team in that conference. I mean, I guess Oklahoma, but they've been competitive. I mean, they were right in the game with Kansas on Monday night. Texas has beaten some teams. Oklahoma's even beaten some teams. That's the best conference in America this year, and you don't really have a terrible team in that league. So, when you're looking at, like, the Big 12, and I don't know how the final seedings are going to shake out because it all depends on matchups, but somebody like an Iowa State that's maybe going to be the 4 seed or potentially the 5 seed in the conference, Oklahoma State, I mean, these are teams you might want to look at and take shots. And, sometimes you can bet these big money lines, and if they reach a certain point, you can kind of go the other way and see if you can guarantee profit. And I will probably end up doing that with a couple of these tournaments. But, I think looking at these, I mean, obviously there's the angle of if you beat a team twice, it's hard to beat them 3 times. But, I mean, I think that's priced in the market. So you want to be careful kind of going blindly off that angle. So you really got to go with situations. One that we saw last night in the Big South was a team that had just played the other team, and that was Longwood against Charleston Southern. This was the first round games kind of getting the main draw of the Big South. And I took Longwood +6 of the first half. They just lost to Charleston Southern, and they ended up covering the first half, and then they got pulled away from, and then they made a run late to make the game competitive. But those are little angles I think you do want to look at in these conference tournaments. If a team just played another team and just lost to them, that gives value, I think, to the team that had lost the previous meeting. So looking at those, I mean, you can find little angles here. You just got to do a little bit of the work and figure it out.
Well, and one of the things that stands out about these tournaments here that are going on this week is that there's only one bid up for grabs. I mean, whoever wins the tournament's going to March Madness. Everybody else will either go to the NIT, CBI, CIT, or not go anywhere. When you get into next week, when you have the major conference tournaments, motivations are a little bit different for everybody. Some teams are already in. They know it. They're not so much worried about what line they're on. So, you know, they may not come to the table as emotionally invested as some of these other teams, especially if they're a team on the bubble that needs to win, you know, maybe two games in the conference tournament to assure itself a spot in the big dance. So is that an angle that you look to play on here as we head into next week?
I do. And I mean, I think some of these depends on the draw. And one thing I do with a lot of these conference tournaments is I go to these conference sites and I will tweet out the brackets. I'll put them in my favorites for pretty much all of the conferences, and then I'll print them out and kind of fill them in as they go along. Some of these conferences are going to have like the double bye, like the ACC, where you have so many teams that you might have a team that has to play once or twice to kind of get in the main draw. So sometimes these double byes, I think, could work against teams in the fact that they haven't played, and you've got teams that have already played, that have already kind of, you know, gotten the juices going, and then you might see some of these double bye teams become a little bit flat in these major tournaments, especially if they know that they're going, because it's a catch 22 with these tournaments, because especially if you got to play a bunch of games, you know, there is the potential to wear yourself down in these tournaments, but it's also a chance to win a championship and hang a banner and get a trophy and win a championship. And that's important for especially these coaches to get bonus incentives in their contracts to win these things. So you want to win these conference tournaments, but you don't want to be dead going into the NCAA tournament. So, you know, there's a lot of different factors at play here. And, you know, we talked about it last week that, you know, you're constantly getting the updates from Joe Lunardi and Jerry Palm and everybody that does all the bracketologists that do these updates of who's in the field and evaluating the RPI and the different metrics. But that's going to be priced into the market in some of these games. And, you know, teams that always have must-win games in terms of like, okay, they're first four out, so they got to win, don't always win. And sometimes with these projections, even though these guys are usually pretty accurate, you know, a team loses a game, that might not mean that they're out. These are still just projections. These guys aren't necessarily on the committee. And you have a different committee every year that's going to look at different things, and that's why you get this debate after the tournament of, oh, why are they in, or why is this team out? Because you have different people that look at different things. There's not always consistency there. Some year they value road and neutral records. Some year they value, schedule strength. And some year it's not much of a factor. So different people have different opinions and different standards by which they evaluate these teams. I know they like to say it's uniform, but it isn't always the case.
One other thing I want to ask you about with regards to conference tournaments is that, you know, the format of this is very different than what we see during the regular season. We'll see teams play twice a week. You know, they'll play Thursday, Saturday, Wednesday, Sunday, you know, whatever the case may be. Sometimes they do play three times if they draw a Monday night game and then have to play a couple more throughout the week. But conference tournaments, it is day after day after day for these teams. How does that impact your handicapping? Because we know that fatigue factor is definitely priced in.
Yeah, and that's where you usually might go for the first half. I'm always somebody that believes that, you know, if a team's going to lose its legs or get kind of tired, it's going to happen more in the second half maybe than it's going to happen in the first half of the game. So, you know, don't be afraid to kind of look maybe towards first halves instead of taking full game, because you might have a team that plays a team on a bye that had to play the previous night against the team that's rested. You know, the team that had to play the previous night may still be going on adrenaline from the previous night, and sometimes that's enough to get them through in the first half. And you may not see the tired legs so much until the second 20 minutes. And I mean, we've seen some teams make these runs where they had to win four games in 4 days. I mean, we've seen UConn do it. I mean, it seems like they've done it a bunch of times. In 1 year, they actually ran it to the finals, the national championship game. So that's not impossible. But I mean, I tend to think there's value in those teams in the first halves that play the night before, because I think they had already played a game, so they'd already gotten maybe some of the anxiousness and the nervousness, especially, you know, if they're on the bubble or if it's a one or a two bid league where it's kind of like you have to win. The team that has the bye still hasn't played yet. I mean, unless there's like such a gap in talent where it's really not going to matter, but the teams are relatively in the same atmosphere and kind of in the same level. There's some value on those first halves on those teams that have played the night before.
One final thing I'll ask you about for today, Wes. Kevin Durant out for at least a month, could be a little bit longer, should be back in time for the first round of the playoffs, but you know, we'll see how the healing process goes. What kind of adjustment do you make for Golden State now?
Yeah, and I actually had the Wizards last night, and it looked like they were going to lose the game to Golden State, but they were able to hit enough shots at the end and make their free throws and end up pulling the outright win. I mean, I think there's definitely, you know, an adjustment, because they didn't really, you know, it went out early, and I mean, I played the over too, and that I think definitely affected their scoring, because the last couple games they really haven't shot the ball well from the three at all. And Stephen Curry, he really struggled last night shooting the three, and has kind of been a little iffy in road games this year. Looking at the numbers that I saw earlier, and I don't have in front of me now, but you know, I think there's probably I'm guessing 1.5 adjustment. I mean, they're still the best team, I think, in the Western Conference. I'll be interesting to see when I look these offshores later that lets you kind of bet season win totals during the season. I mean, most books don't let you do that, but there's a few that will do adjusted season win totals, and that's one where I actually have the under 66.5, and looking at it now, they're 50-10, so there's 22 games left, and they still have to go 17-5 to get you beat on the under. So what I think this injury has done, not that you root for an injury, it's given underbackers of the Golden State season win total at least some life here, you know, where they think, you know, there's still a chance for this to hit. But I still think that they're going to end up with the one seed. They've got about I believe it's a 4-game lead over San Antonio. And we know that San Antonio will go for the playoffs, where Popovich will rest guys on random nights. I mean, it's not as prevalent as it was when they had Tim Duncan, obviously not playing him on back-to-backs. But, you know, there's a little bit of an adjustment here. I haven't seen a line yet for tomorrow. But, you know, it's probably going to be somewhere, maybe a 2-point adjustment, I think, because you do have – you still have offensive firepower. I mean, they had it last year without Durant. I mean, so I don't think it's going to be as big of an adjustment as if LeBron was out for Cleveland or if Westbrook was out for Oklahoma City, simply because they do have more offensive firepower. But there's going to be a small adjustment there, and it's going to be interesting to see kind of how the Warriors approach this, if maybe they rest a guy at some point on a random night. You know, they want the one seed. If they know San Antonio is their nearest challenger and will do that, then maybe Steve Kerr might try to do that at some point.
Good insight today from Wes Reynolds on the show. You can follow him on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Wes, thank you so much for your time, man. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you again next week.
Adam, always a pleasure.
Good stuff there. And you know, certainly with a new venue for that golf tournament, a lot of things to consider. Hopefully our listeners do take something away from that. One more segment left to go here on today's show before I bring Chris Stone on the broadcast. Just want to remind our listeners about the great promo code options available over at DSI Sportsbook. If you use the promo code BTB Radio, you'll get a $10 free bet just for signing up, then an additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. The second option is the Bang 200 promo code, 100% for the sportsbook, 100% for the live casino. Again, you want to make sure you have the ability to shop around here at this time of the year, really at every time of the year. So if you don't have an account over at DSI, please go and check out what they have to offer. As I said, one more guest for today's program. Bring him on the air now. That is Chris Stone of Fansided. Chris, how's it going today, man?
It's going well. How are you doing?
Doing very well. Appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much for joining us. I know you were a little bit of a late ad, so glad I could get you on here because, Chris, this is March.
This is March.
For those that don't know, we're throwing a little bit of shade at somebody that all of us know and probably love to some extent. But, man, the big thing right now that we're looking at in college basketball is the end of the regular season. Obviously, a lot of these small conferences trying to get those automatic bids, and we've talked a lot about those here already so far on the show this week. But the end of the regular season, always very interesting as well. You've got some teams that can pad their resumes, some teams that are going to put themselves on the bubble or push themselves completely off of it. Who are the most compelling teams to watch here over the next 5 days?
Well, I think you're looking at plenty of bubble teams over the next couple of days. To me, the most interesting story is one that will involve a conference tournament, though, and that is Wichita State. I think that their conference tournament is coming up this weekend, and I think that they're a really interesting team, whether or not they're able to win the Missouri Valley tournament and where that would put them in relationship to the bubble. Their resume as a whole is not particularly good. They're 42nd in the RPI right now with just one RPI top 50 win, and that win came against Illinois State in conference play, so they don't have any non-conference wins. So they're the team that I'm kind of keeping an eye on the most because their advanced metrics are awesome. They're top 10 in KenPom. They have the 9th-ranked offense, 24th-ranked defense, and I think if they get into the field, they're a team that can make a deep run like they did a few years ago. But the question is whether or not the committee will kind of stick to their guns on RPI top 50 wins and keep them out if they don't win the Missouri Valley tournament.
I mean, it's hard, right? It's hard to keep out a mid-major that everybody knows. And also one thing that they can do, and of course they've done this to Wichita State in the past, is just screw them with the draw, slap them on the 8 line and tell them, hey, go try and beat one of the top 4 teams in the country.
Yeah, or they can do what they did last year and stick them in a play-in game and say, look, we think you're good enough to be in the field based on the eye test, but we don't really know where to seed you because we don't know how good you are. And so they stick them in a play-in game, which, is perfectly fine because they get into the field, but it's really disadvantageous to some of those other teams that are higher on the seed line because then you have to play a team that's obviously really good. I mean, last year, I think Wichita State played Vanderbilt in the first 4, and then they played Arizona in a 6-11 game in Providence and just kind of took care of Arizona pretty easily. And I think you can run into those same problems, right? If you're a 1 seed and Wichita is your 8 or your 9 seed and you play them in the second round of the tournament, like, you're going to be unhappy. I know that Joe Lenardi's bracket right now over at ESPN has Wichita as the 8 seed in Kansas's region as the 1 seed playing in Tulsa, which is closer to Wichita than it is to Lawrence. So I think that if Wichita State ends up in an 8 or a 9, no matter who is the 1 in that region, that team isn't going to be particularly happy about it because they're not going to be anything more than maybe a 3 or 4 point favorite.
It seems like, according to Lenardi, right now Northwestern is in okay shape, but it would certainly behoove them to win tonight, and if they can find a way to knock off Purdue this weekend, that would probably put them in the tournament, regardless of what they do next week in Indianapolis. But you look at tonight's game, and I mean, they have everything to lose here in this one. They are a pick 'em right now, a couple of shops showing them -1, a couple of shops showing them +1, so that number basically hovering right around pick. Is this a matchup that Northwestern can win? And if so, are they in?
It's certainly one that they can win. I think Michigan's been playing really well recently. And obviously Northwestern has decided to make getting into the NCAA tournament a bit more difficult than everybody expected it would be for them over the last couple of weeks. But I certainly think it's a matchup that Northwestern can win. They're playing at home. They're talented enough defensively to kind of hold off Michigan's offense, I think. But Michigan's been playing really well. In terms of results, I do think that if they win, they're definitely going to be in the field. It would add to their total number of RPI top 50 wins, I think, and would bump them to 4 of those, which should be enough to get them into the tournament. And like you said, obviously, if they beat Purdue on Sunday, I think that they're a lock. I think Northwestern right now is pretty sure to get into the tournament, given that I don't think the bubble has the most exciting set of teams. I mean, we're talking about Illinois, who has beat Northwestern twice as a potential bubble team, but Illinois, other than that, has been pretty bad. So I think Northwestern should be safely in, but obviously if they lose both of these games and then kind of bow out early in the Big Ten tournament, they could be in some trouble.
Well, I know we're talking about some bracketology stuff here, but for our listeners that do tune into this show for the gambling thoughts, and I imagine that's the majority of you, you know, we're talking about teams that have immense pressure here to perform over these last couple of games. And that can be something that's more of a detriment. You know, people talk about, oh, it's a must-win game. Doesn't mean that team always wins. It just means that they're playing with, you know, significantly more pressure. So, you know, there are some situations where that just doesn't work out in a team's favor. We could have one here coming up this weekend on Saturday at the Carrier Dome. Georgia Tech on the road. They beat Syracuse at home. Now they have a chance to pick up what would be a pretty impressive road win over a team that seems to be in the field right now. But, I mean, is this a win and get in kind of game?
Yeah, I mean, this is a difficult one, I think. Georgia Tech has a ton of awesome wins on their resume, but they win over VCU. I think right now they're probably on the outside looking in. A win over Syracuse on the road would certainly help them, but I would expect that they probably need a little bit more than that in the ACC tournament to get the job done. Syracuse, on the other hand, is a team that I think is probably in right now, but has some question marks about their ability to win on the road. I would expect that Syracuse will win this weekend and kind of shore up any real concerns that people have about their ability to get in to the tournament because they're playing at home, because I think they're simply a better team than Georgia Tech. I don't know what the line in that game will be, but I think that Syracuse has really just had their problems on the road. They've been pretty good at home this year. They've beaten Virginia at home, Florida State at home, Duke at home. Those are all really good teams, certainly better than Georgia Tech. So I would lean Syracuse in that game, and I would also think Syracuse is by far more likely to make the NCAA tournament.
A couple of games tonight here on Wednesday night with some pretty big tournament implications. We'll start with Louisville and Wake Forest. Wake Forest catching 3 at home here. According to Lenardi, they're in his first 4 out. I mean, this is a team that has a sub-500 record in the ACC, but they have some of those wins that, you know, the committee's looking for. If they get the win tonight, do they go from first 4 out to last 4 in?
That's possible. I think that the concern that you have with Wake top 50 wins, right, they're 1-9 against the RPI top 50 right now, which puts them in a really difficult spot. I think that they badly need to beat Louisville to get themselves into that conversation and get on the right side of the bubble. It's kind of sad because I think Wake Forest is a really fun team. If you haven't watched them yet, I would highly recommend it. John Collins is one of the most underrated players in the country who is putting up something like 30 points and 15 rebounds per 40 minutes, which is just like absolutely ridiculous. So I think that they probably have to win tonight to make it into the tournament. I don't know that they will win tonight. I'm pretty fond of Louisville. I think that their defense is really, really good. And Donovan Mitchell is another under-the-radar stud in the ACC. But I think that it would certainly go a long way towards shoring up their resume if Wake Forest is able to win tonight, for sure.
It looks like Xavier's firmly in the tournament, but they play Marquette tonight. Marquette, a bubble team. Xavier could fall to the bubble if they lose at home here in this spot. I mean, this is arguably the most important game of the night when you look at teams that are trying to, you know, make sure that they get themselves into the tournament. I mean, Marquette wins on the road here. Does that, you know, put Xavier at risk?
I think Xavier should be at risk in general, but that's my general feeling about how the NCAA tournament committee handles injuries. Xavier without Edmund Sumner has certainly not been the same Xavier team with Edmund Sumner. And I understand that we don't necessarily want to punish people for injuries that happen, but if we're really trying to get the best field of 68, it makes sense, I think, to factor those things in. So I would kind of, I think, already have Xavier in some of those questionable situations, to be honest with you, even though that's maybe a little bit callous at this point. I think that if Xavier loses this game, they could certainly see themselves fall. Lenardi has them as a 9 seed and falling right now, which certainly isn't a good position necessarily to be in going forward. So yeah, I think if they lose, they could find themselves on the bubble. But their RPI is really good, and they don't really have bad losses, which is what's kind of buoying them right now.
So in terms of other teams here, I know we talked about a few games coming up tonight. Who else do you feel like, you know, has a lot to gain here or a lot to lose over the next 5 days?
Well, I think there's a big game that we could consider tonight, which is Kansas State at TCU. Both of those teams, I think, have kind of fallen off in recent weeks and put themselves into difficult positions with regards to being in the NCAA tournament. But I think that you could see a situation where one of them wins a game tonight, maybe wins their second game to close out the regular season and put together something in the Big 12 tournament and could put themselves in an interesting position with regards to the bubble. So I think that's an interesting one. Lenardi has both of those teams in the next four out, and so they're pretty badly in need of a win this evening. Those are two teams that I would keep an eye on, I think, over the next couple of days.
All right, so let's chat a little bit about conference tournaments here. Maybe we can talk a little bit in terms of, you know, what you've seen as a college basketball fan and observer over the last few years, and I know that you've covered a couple in person as well. Let's just talk about the different dynamics. I mean, you know, you talk about motivation for some of these teams, and this will be something that's relevant next week. It's not relevant this week because everybody is motivated in these smaller conferences. They want to get to the big dance. Next week, there are teams that are already in the field, obviously. We've talked about some of them already. We've talked about some that need to win maybe two or three games in their conference tournament just to make sure that they get in the field. You know, in terms of looking at these games, maybe we'll focus first on the big-name teams, Villanova, Kansas, you know, Duke, North Carolina, these teams that are in, they know they're in. There's not as much incentive for them. Are those teams that you'd maybe look to fade a little bit, or are they teams that, you know, still have a lot of pride? They're programs with very decorated histories. They still want to go up there and hang a banner.
Yeah, it's weird, right? I think that the logical thing is for those teams to kind of hang back, not really worry about the conference tournament, maybe rest some guys. So I originally started writing about Kansas, and so I'm kind of tuned into those circles, and I know for sure that a ton of Kansas fans would like to see Bill Self give Frank Mason and Devontae Graham and those guys some rest because they have a short rotation already, but that's just like not really something Bill Self has ever done. So you know that Kansas is going to go out there and they're going to try and win the conference tournament no matter what. And I think that that's probably true across the board. Now, if we can kind of dig into some subconscious motivation, I think that there might be some questions where are guys really going out and giving it. I mean, you can certainly tell that some players play differently in these situations, I think, than in other ones. I would suspect that all of those top teams will obviously go out with the intent to win those conference tournaments. But if things start to go poorly, like let's say they get down 10 or 12 points, it might be easier for that lead or that deficit to get to 20 points rather than for them to close the gap, if that makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense, and that can have some live betting implications for our listeners out there as well. Now, one of the things about these major conference tournaments is that they're all played at neutral sites. In the very small conference tournaments, you've got a little bit of a home court advantage. You know, you certainly do have some schools that have closer proximity to some of these things. You know, obviously, the SEC tournament in Nashville, for example, Vanderbilt's right up the road. But it's a travel destination. We got four conference tournaments in Las Vegas. Fan bases are going to show up. You know, it's the same thing with Nashville. You know, fan bases are going to show up in Indianapolis for the Big Ten. I don't know if they'll show up as much at Madison Square Garden next year. We'll have to see how that plays out. But do you notice, you know, significant crowd advantages here at these neutral site tournaments?
I think it depends on where they're at. There are some interesting ones. So I think at the Big 12 tournament, you notice, I went to that tournament last year, and it's pretty significantly taken over by Kansas fans and by Iowa State fans. Iowa State's won that tournament two of the last 3 years. Their fan base kind of prides themselves on coming down and taking over Kansas City because of how close the Sprint Center is to Lawrence and to the University of Kansas. So I think that that's an interesting one. You always get Kansas fans. You always get Iowa State fans. At that one, those are the two teams that I like to watch at the Big 12 tournament. I think this year you're going to see some interesting stuff in terms of travel for a couple of these tournaments. So the ACC has moved their tournament out of Washington, D.C., and they're playing their tournament at the Barclays Center this season, which is obviously further away from some of the best teams in the conference that are located in North Carolina. And so that'll be interesting to see if people travel up there. And then the Big Ten this year is actually in Washington, D.C. So I'll be at that next weekend. But the interesting thing is that there aren't really Big Ten teams out near Washington other than Maryland. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how well that's attended and see how well some of those fan bases travel.
That's an excellent correction. Thank you for making that there. The Big Ten is, as Chris just said, in Washington, D.C., not in Indianapolis this year. So I do apologize for that. And that is a change. I mean, you talk about these players that they get used to going to a certain place. Now all of a sudden they have to go to an unfamiliar shooting backdrop. Do you feel like that's a problem early on in these tournaments?
Yeah, I certainly think it's something that takes some time to adjust to. We see it most obviously during the Final Four when they play in these bigger stadiums and there's, you know, less of a backdrop for them to look into when they're shooting. But I think that, you know, you get out of your routine a little bit, put in some new positions, have to play in new arenas that you haven't played in before, right? Like I think the only Big Ten team that will have played at the Verizon Center, for example, if I have this right, is probably Maryland this year. And so I'm not sure what it'll be like for those teams coming to a new city. You know, they're having to travel further than they normally do for the conference tournament. It'll be interesting to see how that could affect, you know, perhaps even like over-under numbers as we get closer to seeing those lines.
In your experience there, and I don't know how many games you've maybe gone to there, is it a tough place to shoot?
The Verizon Center? No, not really. Part of that is that it's an NBA arena, right? So that it's not as big as some of the football stadiums that people play in. I generally think people shoot totally fine when they show up there. It's just that, you know, these guys won't have played there before.
Do you think Maryland, you know, shows up in support of the team? Because like you said, I mean, nobody else in the Big Ten is really all that close.
Yeah, I would imagine that there will be plenty of Maryland fans. There are obviously plenty of Maryland fans in D.C. itself. And their team is in a position where they can, you know, make the NCAA tournament, maybe go on a little bit of run if Melo Trimble gets hot. And I think that they'll have quite a few. I think they'll have by far the biggest set of fan support at the Big Ten tournament.
All right, well, let's talk about some things that could make a little bit of a surprising run here. I talked at the top of the show, and I talked right before you came on about, you know, being able to shop around for the best futures prices. And there's not a ton of value on teams like Kansas or the North Carolinas of the world because, you know, the price points just aren't there. What about some teams that could make a pretty interesting Sweet 16 or Elite 8 run that are, you know, kind of outliers, maybe some of those teams that people aren't really talking a whole lot about?
Sure. So one of the teams that I'm actually about to write an article about is Iowa State, and I think that they're an interesting team just because of how hot they can get offensively. Over their last six games, or they've won their last six games, and over that span, they're shooting almost 50% from three. We saw them get super hot and knock out Kansas at Allen Fieldhouse earlier this year. So they're a team that I think can string together a series of hot shooting nights and get into that second weekend and, you know, even potentially make a Final Four if they really get it going with all of those seniors on that roster. So that's a team I think that's interesting and worth keeping an eye on. I think SMU is an interesting team to keep an eye on just because of how different they are from everybody else. They start or play five guys basically who are 6'6 to 6'8. All of them can shoot the three for the most part and step out beyond the arc. And I think that that's going to be difficult for teams to guard, especially the first time that they're seeing it. And I think that's an interesting one. And then the other team, assuming that they get into the field, and I'm almost certain they will, is St. Mary's out in the West Coast Conference. Super efficient offense, decent defense, like to grind it out. I think that they're a team that probably aren't really on the national radar just because of the league that they play in and who they play against. But they're a team that I think could make an interesting run. They've got a really nice big man in Jack Landale who, according to KenPom, is the number two player of the year candidate this year, super efficient scorer. And I think that they're a team that can make a run if they're able to kind of put it all together.
I want to talk about a couple of pretty big contrasts here, and I'm going to use two teams on one side and at least one team on the other. And I think if I think of another one here as I'm going, I'll use them as well. UCLA. So obviously this team can score. Obviously they are insanely talented. They can't really play a whole lot of defense. So when you talk about teams like that, I mean, you know, in the NCAA tournament, really you need to get hot for five games, and there you go, you're in good shape. For a team like UCLA, though, you know, do you feel like offense travels as well as defense? I mean, is that going to be a problem for them?
It'll be interesting to see for sure because they're so reliant on hitting three-point shots. I think that they'll probably be able to score enough. The obvious question, though, is just can UCLA guard anybody? And that's the thing that really holds me back with UCLA. I have a feeling that they're probably have one of the top five odds to win the title right now, and I don't think that they're anywhere close to that. If UCLA wins the title this year, it'll break basically the entirety of precedence that Ken Pom has set in terms of what you need to be defensively to be a title winner. So the worst adjusted defensive efficiency to ever win a title is 93.3, and that was the 2015 Duke team that ranked somewhere like 35th in the nation entering the tournament. UCLA is at 101.4, 95th in the nation right now. And I don't think that they're obviously not going to get anywhere close to 93.3 before this NCAA tournament starts. So, yes, I think they can score, but even if they can score on the road, I'm not sure that they can play enough defense for six games to win a national title.
All right, let me bring another team to the forefront here, another team that's very, very good offensively, Oklahoma State. Do they have enough defensively to make a pretty decent run here for Brad Underwood?
The one interesting thing about Oklahoma State, I think, versus UCLA is that Oklahoma State creates quite a few turnovers, and so I think you could see them maybe lock in a little bit more defensively and create some of those turnovers, right? Brad Underwood is a disciple of Huggins, of Bob Huggins at West Virginia, so he has some of those same principles in terms of how he defends, right? He doesn't do the full court press Virginia, but he does a lot of trapping and stuff in the half court. And so I think maybe you could see Oklahoma State pick up two wins early on if they pick up their defense a bit. The problem with Oklahoma State defensively is just they don't have guys in the middle to deter teams from getting easy shots. They're 272nd right now out of 351 teams in defensive two-point percentage. So, yeah, I think they're going to put points on the board, but it's tough for me to imagine them making a run beyond the second weekend, but I could certainly see them locking up teams for the first two games and making it into the Sweet 16, sure.
Well, those are really good things here for our listeners based on the draw. I mean, if you get a team that's very good on the interior, Oklahoma State's going to have some problems. If it's somebody that relies on jump shooting, yeah, that could be a little bit different of a story. So obviously I talked about a couple of really good offensive teams with some lackluster defenses, so you know what's coming next. Teams that play great defense and have a ton of trouble scoring. I think the biggest one, and you and I have kind of joked a little bit about this team via DM a few times, South Carolina. You know, defense travels, defense wins bowl games, defense should theoretically be more consistent than offense. What's the ceiling for the Gamecocks like?
Yeah, I think that they're a team that can make a second weekend run. They're a team that's done it, I feel like, somewhat recently. Their defense is really outstanding. They put a lot of pressure on teams. They turn teams over. They don't let them get off three-point shots. And when they do get off three-point shots, they're tough and contested ones, and they protect the interior. They're a team that is certainly going to look to lock somebody down, but they're really, really bad offensively. Sindarius Thornwell and P.J. Dozier are great players. They can put the ball in the bucket pretty okay, but they're just not able to get enough points on the board. I think that the toughest thing for South Carolina will be playing teams with a good enough offense to put points on the board, because I think in college basketball, honestly, good offense usually beats good defense, and that's, I think, where it could become troublesome for the Gamecocks.
I imagine you probably thought I was going to Virginia, but I'm not, because Virginia's offense actually isn't all that bad. I'm going to go to Cal. This Cal team, okay, very good defense. Offensively, you know, kind of leaves something to be desired here. I mean, obviously they need to find a way to get themselves into the tournament. That's not exactly a sure thing as of yet. They should probably make their way in, but, you know, we'll have to see how things play out for them over the last few games here. If they do get in, what do you think their ceiling is?
I think that they'll probably have a tougher time getting out of that first weekend of the tournament. I don't know that I trust Charlie Moore as a freshman point guard to be able to score in the same way that, say, Thornwell and Dozier might be able to do. I do like Ivan Rabb as a college player, but, you know, circulating through your offense through the post is only so good this day and age. The biggest question for me might be if California even makes the tournament. They're projected to lose their last two games of the season to Utah and Colorado. They're both road games, so they may be in a difficult spot when it comes to Selection Sunday. But if they get in, their defense doesn't turn teams over like South Carolina. It relies heavily on guys taking or opponents taking shots, missing those shots, and then grabbing those defensive rebounds, which, of course, is always dangerous because if you let teams get shots off in the NCAA tournament, there's always a chance that they make them. And then I just don't know that I trust their good offensive pieces as much as I trust South Carolina's offensive pieces.
thinking way ahead here, obviously this is putting the cart a few paces in front of the horse. Would Cal be a team you would look to go against then as well in the NIT just because of what you just talked about?
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't done a lot of thinking about the NIT, but yeah, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, they're going to be more talented than nearly any team that they play in the NIT, which will obviously be an advantage. But yeah, I could see that being a problem for them in the NIT if they don't turn teams over and they play some of those teams from lower conferences that shoot a ton of threes and shoot them well. That could certainly be a problem.
Well, a lot of brilliant insight today from Chris Stone at C Stone Hoops on Twitter. Chris, anything you've written recently that you want to point our listeners towards?
Oh, I mean, they can just check out my Twitter feed. That's the best way to usually find anything that I am putting out there. I do a 5 takeaways column every Monday, do plenty of NBA draft stuff, should have an article coming out about Iowa State soon. So those are the things to kind of keep an eye on.
Well, Chris, like I said, I know it was a little bit short notice reaching out to you today, so I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Of course. I'll talk to you soon.
Good stuff there from Chris Stone of Fansite. Also writes up a mock draft that you can check out. I believe that's every Thursday. But again, just follow him on Twitter at CStoneHoops. That's going to be the best thing for you. And then also, as he said, he's covering that Big Ten Conference tournament in Washington, D.C. So I want to make sure I had a few minutes here to chat hockey. Also take a look at some baseball stuff. The baseball stuff, really, I don't have a whole lot to add, a whole lot to say, just that American League East season win totals are up over at bangthebook.com. A lot of words, a lot of good thoughts there. If you can, I try not to beg too much for anything like this, but if you can, please share these. You know, I put a lot of time and effort into them. So if we can get as many eyes in front of them as possible, I would certainly appreciate it. You know, it's something I take a lot of pride in, something I set a standard with. This is the fourth year I'm doing them, actually. So I set a standard with these. I wanted to try and keep up that standard as best I could, even though I do a lot more now than I did when I first started these. So, you know, if you can get them out there, share them with people. You know, maybe you got some friends that are fans of a team. I would greatly appreciate it. But as I was saying a little bit there at the top of the show, I think what I'm going to try to do is space these out, post them every other day. So tomorrow I'll post the American League Central. And then as we go into Saturday, I'll post the American League West. Just try and give myself a little bit of a time frame to work on the National League. I have to do all the conference tournament previews for next week as well. So lots of work going on here. Very, very busy time for me. Also, along those same lines, just want to remind our listeners that the next 2 weeks, we're looking at Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday only shows. No Thursday, no Friday. I know for sure there will be no show next Thursday. I have something to take care of, so there will not be a show next Thursday no matter what. But we're hoping to do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, get all of our guests on early in the week so that you'll be ready for conference tournaments, ready for March Madness, and we don't have to interfere too much with your basketball watching because I'm sure a lot of you will be taking days off. Of course, Friday the 17th is St. Patrick's Day, so everyone's going to be drunk and watching college basketball. So I think this is just in everybody's best interest, also to accommodate our guests that give their time for the show. You know, Thursday with two professional handicappers, they got a lot of stuff going on. So we'll try to move them. I believe both of them will be on Tuesday. So we'll probably wind up with a two-hour Tuesday show. Then we'll see what happens with Monday and Wednesday. But I just wanted to make sure that our listeners were aware of that. And that will just be a temporary change here. Of course, we will have some other changes coming once we get into April when it's just the tail end of the NBA and the NHL regular seasons and Major League Baseball. May cut down the shows a little bit. May only do 3 or 4 days a week. We'll let you know what the plans are as we decide them. But there will be some changes coming. And then, of course, we'll pick things up again very heavy once we get into August and start talking college football and the NFL. But I wanted to spend a few minutes here on the NHL with you today. Obviously, things are pretty interesting in the NHL right now. We've got the NHL trade deadline. And is shaping up to be a little bit watered down compared to what we usually see. But there are a few things I want to bring to your attention. For one thing, we have expansion franchise coming in next year, the Vegas Golden Knights, which is an awful name and the logo sucks, but we have a new team coming in. We're going to have an expansion draft. There are certain requirements for teams in order to be able to protect players, which could be something that they try to address here at the trade deadline. Teams want to make sure that they get, you know, maybe a spare goaltender, or a spare forward, spare defenseman, something like that. Especially if you see deals being made by teams that aren't very good, teams that don't have any reason to buy but have reason to protect some of the players that they do have in-house right now. So that is something that could have a little bit of an impact here on the trade deadline. We've seen some deals already. I was very impressed with how the Capitals looked with Kevin Shattenkirk in the lineup yesterday in their win over the Rangers. They were without Brooks Orpik and TJ Oshie and still carried the play for the better part of the final two periods of that game. Very, very impressed with the Capitals. There's probably no futures value on the Washington Capitals, but for me, as things currently stand, so long as they're healthy going into the playoffs, they are the team that I like to take down the Stanley Cup. I know they have their playoff failures in the past, but it's a really, really strong team. The Florida Panthers made a trade. They picked up Thomas Vanek from the Detroit Red Wings. Now, for the Detroit Red Wings, they were a bad, bad, bad team when Vanek was out of the lineup. Vanek was hurt for a little while. They were awful. They could not score goals. They had all sorts of problems. So, you know, that's a team that you can probably look to fade a little bit here. I know that they don't – there's not great odds in going against them anyway, you know, just because they're such a big underdog all the time. But Thomas Vanek is a player that could help Florida. However, when I look at Florida, I see a team that has more problems defensively and in net than up front. You know, since Barkov and Huberdeau came back, they're in good shape. They have okay depth up front with, you know, guys like Vincent Trocheck, Jonathan Marchessault. They have guys that can play up front. I think the problem for them is defensively, they give up a lot of high-quality shots. I don't think their transition game is particularly spectacular. So while Vanek will help, while Vanek is a goal scorer, I think they still need to address the defense. If they don't do that, you know, I may have a few more worries about them going forward here. So while I do like Florida, while I do still think that there's some you know, upside for them, and I talked about them as a futures play before that number got away from us a little bit, you know, I think Vanek helps. I don't think he upsets the balance of the team too much. I think it'll help on the power play as well because he's a finisher. But, you know, really it's been a very watered-down trade deadline here because we had some deals take place early in the week. Martin Hanzel was on the move. Ken Shattenkirk was already on the move. Dwight King goes from the Kings to the Canadiens. That's not really a move that's going to move the needle too much for me. So, been fairly slow here today. I think we could see action pick up a little bit closer to the 3 o'clock deadline. But again, be on the lookout for those teams that are picking up pieces for expansion draft purposes. So let's talk about some actual games here. Tonight, the Pittsburgh Penguins take on the Chicago Blackhawks. Now, the Penguins lost the other night to the Dallas Stars, and this is a team that Rob Pizzola isolated and mentioned last week, kind of in pretty tough shape right now because they have a lot of guys hurt. They're missing some key defensemen. Connor Sheary takes away an element of their speed up front. The Penguins are really shorthanded right now. Chicago opened a minus 130 favorite tonight. It's up to minus 140 at the Chris Books. Still hovering in the minus 135 range in a lot of places. You have to like Chicago here tonight. You know, the Blackhawks are playing a lot better. Pittsburgh has some uncertain times with Marc-Andre Fleury. If he's not traded now, they'll let him go in the offseason. It's just it's challenging. You know, when you talk about players that have been in a city on a team for a long time, and they're on the market like this very openly, it's tough for a team. You know, and the Penguins are already down several key players. It's just a little bit of a challenge for them. They know they're going to make the playoffs. I don't think they necessarily care about where they're seated. Chicago, on the other hand, you know, rounding into form, starting to play a lot better. I think there's good value tonight in the Blackhawks. Catch one of those minus 130, minus 135 prices. You should be sitting pretty there with that one. Carolina, Tampa Bay, the only other game tonight. I previewed that one over at bangthebook.com, but the Tampa Bay Lightning got steamed again. They got steamed on Tuesday or on Monday night. They're steamed again tonight. Pretty interesting to see how things are going there with Tampa Bay. They traded Brian Boyle away, but they're still getting steamed out there from the sharper, more influential bettors. So maybe Tampa Bay, a team that you want to look to get into the market with a little bit earlier here than they have been in the past. Let's look ahead to Thursday. Very interesting game coming up on Thursday. The Minnesota Wild take on the Columbus Blue Jackets. Now, when these two teams played earlier this year, Columbus was riding a 14-game winning streak. Minnesota was riding a 12-game winning streak. Is this a revenge game for Minnesota? I certainly think that you could make that claim. You know, I mean, Columbus was obviously hotter than anybody coming into that spot, but the Wild lost at home, and I think they should be pretty motivated here. I also think the Blue Jackets will be very motivated as well. Should be a good game Thursday night. Minnesota dealing with a mumps outbreak. That's clearly a concern for them. I'll be curious to see where this number opens. I think Columbus, maybe in the minus 140 range, could be where this thing comes out. Because you have that mumps issue with the Wild, maybe there's a bit of value there on Minnesota at plus 120. I don't know for sure, but that'd be an interesting line to watch and also an interesting game to see the line movement there. Another game on my radar for Thursday night, excuse me, the New York Islanders and the Dallas Stars. So the Islanders were rolling. They were playing very, very well under new head coach Dougie Waite. They go into Columbus over the weekend. Columbus coming off the break. The Islanders get buried 7-0. Their first time back out on the ice here is this game against Dallas. I like the Islanders in this spot. I'm curious to see what the price will look like. But, you know, Dallas is not a team that impresses me. Their goaltending is not very good. The Islanders don't have great goaltending either. So this could be a little bit of a wide open game. Maybe you see an over type of game here in this one. But I think the Islanders, with some time to, you know, catch up, I think it was a good loss for them. You know, if you're playing really well and you lose 3-2 in overtime, it can be a little bit challenging. You get blown out 7-0, you say, okay, it happens. It's 1 of 82. Let's get back at it. I think that's an angle that could help the Islanders a little bit here in this spot. So I do like them on the road at Dallas. Again, we'll see what that price opens up. I think they're probably a little bit of a road favorite, maybe the minus 115 range. But I would look to grab that one because I think the Islanders get steamed a little bit there in that one. One other game for Thursday night to keep an eye on here, the Rangers and the Bruins. Lots of speed in this one. Should be a very, very good game. We've seen the markets really love Boston here of late. I think that trend continues. I think if you wait this one out, you should get the Rangers at a little bit better of a price point. And I do like the Rangers going forward. Their depth is incredible. They've got great speed up front. So I think if you wait on this one, you probably get a decent price on the Rangers. I think that would probably be the way that I would look here for Thursday night. So probably chat about some of Friday's games coming up here on Friday. Rob Pizzola can't join the show. He'll be at the Sloan Analytics Conference on Boston, so he can't make it. But I'll chat some more NHL here coming up on Friday's broadcast. But in the meantime, check out that situational betting article both for the NHL and the NBA over at bettingthebook.com and give those win totals a look. See if you can find some interesting nuggets to keep in the back of your mind here as we get closer to baseball season. Coming up on Thursday, we'll have our Thursday meeting show. Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com, Ralph Michaels of WagerTalk.com. We'll chat conference tournaments, a lot of the same things we've talked about here throughout the week, just getting a couple of different perspectives. So I'll do it for today. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.